Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
So good morning to all of you. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a true pleasure and honor to be here. And I must confess that the hospitality and friendship that I and that we are all experiencing is amazing. So thank you, Morten. Thank you, Professor Sinha. To all of you, thank you so much. For making this possible. So I will talk about a concept that I would like to pitch, which I have called normative openness, which is basically about coming to terms with pluralism, value pluralism, justificatory pluralism in international criminal justice. Since it's a challenge to start a conference at 8:30, at least for me, and I'm quite amazed that so many of you made it and that I made it myself, I rather wanted to, instead of starting with a conceptual analysis, I want to start with pictures. So let's start with cats. But since I'm not a cat person, actually, what I will pitch is that we need to overcome those cats in order to understand normative openness, and of course cats are a metaphor for certain positions, and I will explain that. So what I will do first is, in order to explain what normative openness, what justificatory pluralism is about, we need not to look to normative openness, but to the open normativity of international criminal justice. In my eyes, and I presume in the many of yours, international criminal justice is at heart a normative project, not so much a coercive one. But the normativity of international criminal justice is open. It's undecided. I would pitch undecidable, and that is malleable. And that also means exploitable to ends that we might not find very nice. That ICJ is a normative project. We could talk about that for hours, I presume. So let me just be clear on that. I think many criticisms that we have heard, including the one that ICJ is primarily a Western neocolonial project, it's actually that fear that the normativity behind that is imperialism, neo-imperialism, neocolonialism, and that is what maybe a lot of people are afraid of. So that is where this normativity of ICJ might be an issue. But the interesting point that I wanted to make is that this normativity is rather open. So there is no void, no deficit, no lack of theories, of intuitions, for those of you who have not yet completely reflected everything. So maybe there's not a theory behind it, but it's an intuition, which we can then trace back to a theory. Theories, intuitions on many foundational, if not all foundational issues of ICJ are open. So why do we punish? Why do we criminalize? And are these actually two separate questions? For whom are we doing this? For the Western societies who might have a fig leaf to say, well, we did international criminal justice, so we didn't have to intervene in Rwanda in the first place. Are we doing it for the victims? Are we doing it for local communities, for the international community of states? So that for whom is really open? Against whom do we focus? Big fish, small fish, paper pushers, industrial, military, political, cultural leaders, etc. So for whom is rather open? And this intuition that we should focus on the big fish, so the leaders, that is not the reality on the ground. If you remember from Tadic to Lubanga, these were small to medium fish. The idea was, you know, to start small and then crawl up, case building. To what degree shall we do international criminal justice universally against everyone everywhere? Or are we content, should be we content with symbolic trials, symbolic justice? And when do we want to implement international criminal justice? Right away when the conflict starts, after the conflict, and when do we want to have it take effects? Don't remember, or don't forget that, for example, the Nuremberg precedent, I think, only has now effects 40, 50 years after the trial. took place, or the trial took place in the German society where the Nuremberg account has seeped into the German society. Now, we could go on talking about these questions for ages, but the point that I want to make here is that these questions are open, and that there is that this open normativity of international criminal justice points to the fact of justificatory pluralism, to the indeterminacy of rational justification, a vast space of acceptable reasons in the criminal law and the international criminal justice system. And that actually leads to two challenges that I copy-pasted to an extent from Rawls, challenges of legitimacy and stability. For if there is value pluralism, etc., how can we then legitimize subjecting the addressees of international criminal justice to one comprehensive legal regime? That's a top-down view, and the bottom-up would be how can we secure stability, how can we secure that the addressees of international criminal justice willingly comply with one system, one legal regime, if they abide by a multitude of worldviews. Now, the reaction to this open normativity, there is maybe three. The first one would be, let's seek normative closure. So if there's openness, then let's close it. And I think that is the common strategy. Strategies that we also heard yesterday about. So we bring on Gandhi, Foucault, whoever, or ourselves, bringing arguments of how to frame international criminal justice. So that would be the first reaction. The second would be, let's be pragmatic, hands-on, and disregard it, this open normativity. And that is actually an interesting reaction because you get that a lot, especially from practitioners, but also from doctrinalists. And the interesting story here is it does work. You can actually run a criminal justice system rather effectively without knowing what it is exactly about. And the third reaction would be, so what? You know, what am I actually talking about? Open normativity, yes, congratulations. But the national criminal law, probably the law as such, is open. And this is actually where my cats come in, because the first cat is happy cat. And that is the happy cat for the legal philosophers, legal theorists. We are really happy to face an open system that because we can now bring on our own theories to close it. Second would be the cat with the closed eyes, so content cat. Well, let's just, you know, focus on individual subject matters and, you know, not reflect so much on foundational issues. And the third cat would be bored cat. So what? I, as I said, I'm not so much a cat person. My pitch is a different one. So what I would like to say is that we should focus on this very openness, actually. So we have to address this openness as such, this normative openness as such. So we have to switch our focus from open normativity to normative openness. The first reaction, or first maybe a nuanced thing that I would say is that the open normativity of the criminal law is, yes, it is a general phenomenon. In ICJ, it is rather manifest. If you look a little closely in national jurisdictions, it might not be as manifest, but it's there latent, especially if you come up with a comparative legal approach. You see just how many things you can connote to the criminal law. But let's forget the details here. So let's just, I just want to say that in my eyes, this openness is a general phenomena, so that we must and that we should focus on a blind spot that we have so far overlooked, the openness as such. And that brings me to a couple of questions that we then have to ask. For first of all, what are the sociological functions of normative openness? What externalities does it trigger? What does it actually do, that do good or do bad, that the criminal law, that international criminal justice is open? In the paper, I will go into that. Just in this context, let me say that one of the consequences, I would imagine, of this normative openness in international criminal justice is that it does destabilize the system. That is, I think, what we experience now in Africa. It does destabilize because people can criticize the international criminal justice system easily. For example, on the grounds that it is a court for Africa, although I'm not quite sure whether that is really what the protagonists behind the withdrawals really have in mind. I think they have hardcore power interests in mind, and not so much civil disobedience, Gandhi style, as we heard yesterday. But I will not focus on that today. Rather, I want to ask the second question, that is, how, from a normative perspective, shall we approach this normative openness? So shall we theoretically, conceptually, neutralize it, grudgingly manage it, embrace it, or even cherish it? And there is theories, methods, schools of thought out there that can answer to each and every of these suggestions. So neutralization would, for example, be a Rawlsian or a Habermasian account where we try to come to a consensus, overlapping consensus, or at least agreement on certain issues. So we, as I said, close it down, seek normative closure by whatever means necessary to do away with normative openness. We can manage it. We can cherish it. There is schools of thought out there who cherish the agonism which is behind it, for the sake of bringing about inclusions. So if decisions are to be made which favor one set of values, then does actually bring about inclusion of those who favor that very value set. I, for the last five, how many more minutes do I have?
Five.
5 minutes. I would like to suggest embracing normative openness, and I'll do that very fast. So to be clear, if justificatory pluralism is a fact that we have to acknowledge, then it does also persist in international criminal law. And that comes maybe as a shock for the international lawyers amongst you that there is no consensus and agreement, but I think we can see that now, that although the system of international law is so much built on this idea of consensus and agreement, in fact, I'm not quite sure whether that is correct. And in many instances, one could also imagine that international law plays with constructive ambiguity. So come to a pseudo agreement and have the real discussions later. That also means that decisions within and without the law are inevitable, decisions on the undecidable, which means that we need to exclude in these decisions from an output side unacceptable as well as acceptable reasons that at some instances, and in this case I'm afraid I have to differ from what has also been suggested yesterday, decisions which cannot reconcile everything that is in place. Take the Lubanga decision. So it's a very easy decision. We have one person in custody, and now we have to decide with what crimes to charge him with. So we could go for child soldier-related core crimes or gender-related core crimes, which is more grave. Good question. You can answer in both ways. And actually, you have to ask yourself, is gravity actually what is at stake, or are there other prosecutorial strategies that we have to follow through? So my bid to embrace normative openness is the pitch to give it room, but also to tame it in order to establish certain checks and balances. Why? For three reasons, 1 minute each for reasons. First, to ensure the accountability of decision makers. If decision maker can no longer pretend that they speak in the name of objectivity and of what is right, then that ensures a certain, at least self-reflective accountability for decision makers. Be it that they really believe that they are speaking from an objective point of view, albeit that they only pretend to do so. We do broaden the inclusiveness of international criminal justice. That is what Morten yesterday said, widening the discourse community. We have to refocus, in my eyes, from the output to the input and throughput side, which means we do not only have to look to what reasons are there at the end when the decision has been made, to the reasons that carried a decision. We have to refocus also to bring people to the virtual deliberation and negotiation table. So that is the idea of strengthening input and throughput legitimacy. And finally, if we have people commit to normative openness, to show tolerance towards acceptable reasons, justificatory orders of others, that ensures the revisability of dominant as well as of outlier positions. So, because then we are in a system which is contingent, which is dynamic, and where what has been decided can actually be rechecked for whether it is still valid or not, whether the reasons that carry the decisions, still and do carry water. Now, if we apply this standard to the initial challenges of stability and legitimacy, then we have to probably thin it down a little bit. So we cannot go for the high stakes legitimacy where we ensure extremely strong legitimacy. We have to be content with checks and balances, communicative legitimacy, where we can ensure that subjecting the addressees of ICJ is legitimate because they were included in the process of the decision making, not necessarily because their decisions, their reasons, their value systems, their moral compasses actually live forth in a decision that was being made. And that also might ensure the stability of that system if we refocus away from actual acceptance and to acceptability. Acceptability meaning that, again, we have people bring their opinions to the table, really hear them out, deliberate, and if that deliberation then shows that a different value system prevails, then so be it. But at least they were not forgotten, they were not left out of the decision-making process. So my bit to sum it up is to bring all those micro-perspectives that are out there together to establish a certain macro-perspective, that is normative openness, to reconcile these issues, at least in a debate, even where the reasons, the justificatory orders, the normative orders that are in play are colliding, incommensurable, and the such. But at least the process is fairer than to stipulate that a decision is based on objectivity and the truth. So if you want to write me, and this is my last sentence then, is if you have time now to comment afterwards, of course, do so. If not, write me an email, give me comments, suggestions, critique, and I'm very sorry if any cat lovers are around you. I like cats as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.